You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Palazzolo's joined by former co-host of the PFF NFL Podcast back in the day, Mike Renner. Making his return. How you doing, buddy?
Doing great. That was, gosh, what was it, two years ago? It's been a minute now.
And yeah.
I still got the Sam Monson face behind me, which I'm not too thrilled about, but.
Oh, how did we not?
Yeah.
Oh, we do have a headshot of you that we can, if we could stitch that in
that
at some point.
That is also very dated.
Yeah, that's also dated. You've rebranded your current look, and you guys are rebranding the 2-for-1 Drafts podcast, yeah. Right? How about that?
Evolving. I like to call it evolving.
Evolving, huh?
It's evolving, too.
How are you guys evolving the 2-for-1 Drafts podcast? Aren't you rebranding in a couple weeks?
Yeah, well, not going to drop the name just yet.
Okay.
But it's going to rebrand in the middle of July. We're going to revamp to it's called 2-for-1 Drafts, and no one knows why it's called 2-for-1 Drafts. Truthfully, it was a dumb name from the beginning.
It's going to be called Weekend Stories or something.
Yeah, basically. But it's not to pigeonhole us into just, it was a Rookies and Drafts podcast, which is a niche. You just like stories happen during the season that you would like to talk about that you're just like, no, we're a Rookies and Drafts podcast. We're not going to talk about that.
Right.
And so now we're going to touch on more than just Rookies and Drafts. It's going to be the scope of it. So.
All right. Well, that makes sense. So if people go and subscribe right now to 2-for-1 Drafts,
yes,
it'll be the same feed. It'll just be, I can't wait to see. It's going to be like corporate Mike showing up and everything.
I'll wear suits every podcast.
Yes. I can't wait. That's going to be part of the rebrand, right?
Yeah.
I'll
have to show up on time too, apparently.
Yeah. You got to be on time.
I do that.
Got to be decked out. No more joggers as business cash, as we say, right?
Yeah. Sadly.
So go check that out. 2-for-1 Drafts podcast. But we got Mike on the show here. I just wanted to talk general. What did I title this? Secrets of the PFF Player Evaluation System. Yeah. That should draw people in. But we'll talk about how we have evaluated draft prospects through the years, how you like to do it, because you are the person behind our draft boards and all the draft analysis and everything. So we'll talk a little bit about that, yeah?
Yeah, the evolution. Evolved is the key word on this show. The evolution from just looking back, and I've done a lot of looking back at past draft evals that we said over the past month and a half or so, whatever, since the drafts ended, and kind of just how we approached it back then and what we looked for, how we kind of came to our big boards, and then how we approach it now and how we're trying to approach it in the future
and where we're going. All right, well, we could get into that, and we'll do a little preview of the 2022 draft. Very light.
Yes.
Light preview, just to figure out where the strengths and weaknesses are. But let's get into the player evaluation system right now, because if you have premium stats for the NFL, you know that goes all the way back to 2006. If you have it for college, which, by the way, it's a separate subscription, but if you have it for college, it goes back to 2014, the first year that we graded every player on every player on every play in college football. What have you found over the last month and a half about how we have taken the grades and tried to put them into, say, draft boards and projecting players?
Yeah, I mean, I've gone back to the focus draft, the first one we did, the focus mock way back in 2015, that was.
That almost doesn't even count. Some of them do. Some of the picks count. So, Troy Hill counts.
So for context on that, I think that mock draft, we finished grading that first season, so it was 2014 season. We finished grading, what, like a month before the draft?
Yeah.
That's we finished grading all the college games.
By the way, famous PFF story here. This was, Chris bought the company just before the 2014 season. We had about 10 people who graded every single game in the NFL that got us through the NFL. Neil assured Chris that we would also do the college football season that year. And Chris looks at him and says, okay, how many more guys do we have to hire? And Neil just looks at him and says, zero. That means all of us took our normal workload, added 868 games, whatever it is, to it, and we finished grading every single college game the night of the Super Bowl, which was like our soft deadline. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Sorry, just to... I thought the story was great because we all, like, crammed the month of January to make sure that we got those games done. So, yeah, the 2014 season was drafted for the 15 draft.
Yeah.
A couple months in.
And so that one we had... No, we had famously, I will say, famously Trey Flowers as a first rounder, famously Grady Jarrett as a first rounder in those years, went fourth and fifth
and
round.
And then not so famously.
Not so famously. I mean, Troy Hill, actually, we
Gary
had as
Peters.
A first rounder. Gary Peters, we ended up in the second
round. Second round? Okay.
But Gary Peters, we had Jalen Strong in the top 15 that year.
Yeah.
Some L's as well. But we, I think the biggest thing we came at it in the beginning was production. Like, it was... How productive were we at a college football field? And that was the guys that were most productive. Shane Ray at eighth. He had the highest pass rushing grade in the country that year.
Yeah.
We're like, okay, highest pass rushing grade, you're top 10 pick. When it's like, there are every guy, I think the biggest thing I've learned is that every single guy, outside of a few outliers, has to improve once they get to the NFL. They have to get better in some way, shape, or form. And so the guys that can improve, the guys that have the physical tools to make their life easier in some aspect are the ones that can, I guess, like, then improve more. I'm not sure exactly what you're saying.
Like, so you, other than, say, the Boses.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, so it's like
the Boses. I mean, Sam, who's, by the way, Sam will be back next week if you guys miss him. Sam famously mentions, like, the knock on Joey Bosa was people thought he was maxed out. It's like, okay, fine, but maxed out Joey Bosa is a top 10 edge already, right? So those guys still seem to be outliers, the Bosas and Garrett and Chase Young, right? They're at the high end.
But you're saying identifying what can improve.
Yes. So what can improve, but also just what are you doing at the college level that will translate, right?
Yes.
And because grades are constructed, grades are production-based, but there are so many different schemes and things that people are asked to do, and then athleticism matters certainly at other positions,
right? I think what can improve and then roll. So like Scooby Wright, famously, we called him like a second rounder. And it's like his role was playing spot drop zone in Arizona's defense or blitzing.
Right.
That doesn't exist in the NFL. You can't just back off into off cover three and sit and make tackles in front of you all day long against tight ends. That's not going to happen. Like,
right.
you're guarding wide receivers if you're a linebacker in today's NFL. And so you better move like a cornerback if you're going to go in the first round, you're going to go in the second round. You're going to be that guy that's coveted. So I think those are the biggest things that have evolved our process. And like I said, recognizing the role and then recognizing what can improve. And so just because a guy grades well doesn't necessarily, if he did it in a role that's going to be nothing like what he's going to be asked to do in the NFL, and he kind of throw that grade out the window then and see, try to isolate the areas where he is going to be asked to do what he's going to do in the NFL and then evaluate those.
So linebackers were definitely some of our early misses.
Yeah.
Scooby Wright, Paul Dawson, those were guys who were bad athletes.
Now, Paul Dawson... You've heard the stories around Cincinnati, and it wasn't just...
There was some off-field as well. Right.
Was not just the fact that he ran a 4.9.
But even if he was to play,
it
probably would have been a challenge at his athletic level. You do have guys like TJ Edwards with the Eagles. You don't want to go to like just specific one-offs here and there. But either way, we, early on, our biggest misses, I would say, unathletic linebackers who were productive, struggled. And then there was a guy like Deion Jones who did not grade well in college and was extremely athletic. I've got a theory that linebacker, and I'd like to know what your thoughts are on this, that linebacker is becoming the most challenging position on defense. I know corner is always, you know, you're one-on-one, you're on an island. But linebacker, everything offenses are doing is to try to put, is to just make linebackers wrong, and you must see this a ton at the college level.
Yeah, I think I said on one of the pods we just did that SEC linebackers this past year were under siege. They were under attack. Like every single offense in the SEC, Florida, Alabama, their playbook was intended on like you said, making them wrong.
Yeah.
Like they have no right answer. And so you're going to get, you know, downgrades on their grading profile, like their coverage downgrades, where it's like, I don't know, unless you're Reuben Foster, you know, you're not making these plays. Right. You know, unless you really are seeing the game at Luke Kuechly's level, you're not making these plays because you have three different things going on that you're seeing at once that you have to account for all of them. And I think a lot of that falls on DCs then at that point. And that's why I don't think a lot of linebackers get – a lot of people see linebackers as replaceable in the NFL, or a lot of teams don't invest in them because it's a very scheme-dependent position also.
Even I try to explain our grades as well at the NFL level, you know, because – Devin White's a guy who comes up a lot and makes a lot of splash plays, but a lot of them are as a blitzer, and you know, he flies around the field. He makes a lot of positives, but I think also the casual fan doesn't realize the 20-yard dig route, you know, over the middle of the field is often in part because of the linebacker, right? Mm-hmm. Is because he's not getting depth and all these things. I just think everything that they're asked to do, get depth in zone, work downhill, cover a tight end man-to-man, cover a back man-to-man, tackle Lamar Jackson in the open field, take on a pulling guard, all the things they have to do, that's like 15 skill sets rolled into one.
Yeah.
At linebacker.
It really, I think that is the biggest thing. It's, you can be exceptional in one aspect and very deficient in another aspect. Because, like you said, being able to recognize play action and drop under a crosser is not the same as being able to track down a running back in the flat. They're not even like close to the same thing. One, you're going backwards. One, you're going forwards. One's like, how fast you're reading the play. One is just purely reacting. So that is the tough thing about linebackers, that, like I said, it's going to be role dependent. It's going to be what you're asked to do. It's going to kind of dictate how you then produce.
How much do you take the Senior Bowl into account then at those positions where you do get to see a guy? I mean, you might see more reps in three Senior Bowl practices that are NFL-ish, right, than what you see in 500 snaps, 800 snaps maybe in college, right? So how have you taken the Senior Bowl?
I love the Senior Bowl for line of scrimmage.
Yeah.
One-on-ones on the corners and wide receivers and that sort of stuff is good. I do think the big ends of the spectrum, like if a guy does not lose – or vice versa, if a guy doesn't win, obviously that's a big red flag. But I do think for the line of scrimmage, because a lot of times you don't see that because it's such a physically demanding position. There are so few guys who are 6'4", 260, so a defensive end, 6'4", 260 that run a 4.6. There's so few guys that even a Pac-12 offensive tackle may not see one all year, one guy that could sniff the NFL in that regard. And so at that point, if you're not facing one single guy, it's like, it's not close. It's not near the same thing blocking a guy who's just not athletically or maybe size-wise at an NFL level. It's just a completely different animal. So I do think it's big for those evals, even though it is not a lot of reps. And that's one thing I told.
Everything's a small sample size.
Yeah,
right?
That's one thing I told Eric Galco, who's the new Shrine Bowl. I'm like, just get more of these one-on-one reps. Let's see more of them. I don't care about these run blocking drills that you're doing to like you're really going to coach a guy over the course of a week. It's like, let's see them actually, let's get them better for evaluation, what they can actually do, because they're not going to change who they are over the course of three practices.
That was, I think it was Mike Martz famously. Remember Andre Woodson, the QB out of Kentucky years ago? I think Mike Martz was the Senior Bowl offensive coach or whatever, and he was like, oh no, I like my quarterbacks to take their dropbacks like this, and he's probably doing the old school, like he was changing their mechanics and everything. It's like, man, this is a showcase. I'm just trying to zip it around here.
Yeah, like changing their mechanics, it's gonna be a bad eval then. Like it's gonna be worse for the eval and try to get them to do something they've never done before.
You want the guys to look good, not necessarily fit them into your system for 3 days. So that what else? I do want to get into like how the college game has evolved, because I think since we started, you're seeing defense. So offenses started running more RPOs, and it's like, man, there goes our offensive line evaluation. We don't get to see them in pass protection. Now defenses are adjusting, and it's like a completely different game. It's just big dudes, three-man lines. You don't have two edge rushers. So now it's affecting the defensive side of the ball. It's just making it more difficult to evaluate players, man.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing there that we've improved upon, I touched on, you know, Jalen Strong, we had in the top 15. We had Corey Coleman, Josh Doctson as top 10 players when they were coming out. So wide receivers, recognizing what production kind of matters, or, yeah, or where to look and what's going to translate to the NFL to kind of limit your busts, to really identify the guys who will still succeed, the Michael Thomases of the world, the AJ Browns, the guys, DK Metcalf, we had them 1 and 2 that year, to recognize that, yeah, DK Metcalf was not productive in college by any sort of total production metric, by even PFF grades, because of the role he was in. But where he won and the way he won is where he wanted to win at the NFL. You know, he was able to win on the vertical route tree consistently, even if it didn't end up to a lot of yards because his quarterback's pretty tough situation. He was just running the vertical tree there at Ole Miss. So I do think that that's, you know, winning at the line of scrimmage and beating man coverage, one-on-one coverage, is so far more important than just racking up empty yards.
One of the other things I think there was 1 year I think we had 7 or 8 interior defensive linemen as, say, first or second round picks. And a lot of it, there was a lot of good college run defenders coming out that year. And even the way the draft unfolded, this was like Austin Johnson from Penn State. And this is, I think it was A'shaun Robinson and Jaron Reed in the same draft. It was all these guys. I've seen other people say this too. And I think a challenging thing is, just because you can see it and recognize it doesn't mean it's valuable. To me, that's one of the most difficult things to understand as an evaluator. So, like, it's easy to see a guy win all the time in the run game and say, I see that, I can evaluate it, and I know this guy's good, check that box. And I think that makes you want to rank a guy higher, right?
Yeah.
And that's different, and so it's being able to sort through the stuff that you know you can quantify versus the stuff you know is valuable, to your point.
And I think that's even like NFL play callers, I still think that's a lot of the big bias towards running backs and maybe box safeties drafting like a Jonathan Abram in the first round, where it's like, oh, he's going to make a lot more plays. Well, it's like that play, difference between a Jonathan Abram making XYZ play and some other safety who maybe is not going to be as good as Jonathan Abram in the run game, is 3 yards, 2 or 3 yards. The difference between the plays and coverage that Jonathan Abram makes or busts, and the difference between the play and coverage that, a better coverage safety makes, is 25 yards, 30 yards. They're good, the point, big plays that end up, who is it? Urban Meyer talking about explosive plays. That's what they're trying to generate. That's how teams score in the NFL nowadays. That's the difference between, like I said, a box safety and a better coverage safety.
So where else did you go when you're looking back? Any other big takeaways? Were there specific takeaways? Were there certain positions? Because I know what our grades are strong at as far as, positionally, and you could find, the stable numbers and unstable numbers, and we do that.
I think the biggest thing then, the last thing, I mentioned wide receivers, and I think we've done a lot better on wide receivers. Like, even compared to like the NFL, I feel like we've been pretty good at wide receivers and evolving how we evaluate that. But it's still the position where it's still kind of just, I'm not sure anyone's quarterback. And it's the most valuable one, and you get all this accuracy data, you get all this throw charting, and we have an incredible amount, more than anyone's ever had at the position. And it's still so dependent on, it's just so dependent on all, so many other factors that it is difficult to really nail down that position. No one's nailed it down.
So from a PFF standpoint, guys who did not crush it from a grade standpoint, Patrick Mahomes, Dak Prescott, Justin Herbert, even though he was on his way,
I'd say he was fine though. He had a 90 plus grade at one point.
He did, but he didn't really progress. I mean, his career on paper looked a little bit like Josh Rosen. He had a higher peak than Josh Rosen, but it never really got better.
I feel like Herbert's was more, I always just kept coming back to Herbert's like mental side of the game was so odd. Like, he had so many odd decisions on his tape, like sliding short on third down.
Throwing
a Hail Mary out of the back of the end zone, taking a massive shot, diving for the end zone when they were down like 24 points with a minute left. And it's like just these plays where it's just, that is not, it just, that's what that, that's why I was low on Herbert. It wasn't necessarily the arm talent and ability to play quarterback. It was kind of the mental aspect of the game was so off in a lot of different games.
So how do you think quarterback evaluation is evolving? Because Josh Allen has has essentially bucked the trend. My famous line I say on here all the time is players don't just get better like it's like it's a Madden game, right? You don't just add 4 points to their overall every year.
Yeah.
You know, guys go up, they go down. And almost every quarterback in the NFL is more dependent on their supporting cast, I think maybe more than ever. I think there's fewer guys at the top end of the quarterback spectrum that are just, you know, supporting cast agnostic, so to speak, where they can always carry their team. So that's the truth. And then you have a guy like Allen who's taken the arm talent and feel, you know, has the position evolved essentially that you have to make the plays outside the pocket. There's like, should we have been higher on a Mac Jones who was really productive, or are we gun shy on that because of the outside the pocket stuff?
I think I don't think it's the outside the pocket stuff. I think it's the way NFL offenses have evolved. And you just look at the game now compared to 5 years ago, the ability to create open throws for quarterbacks. Far more offenses have that. You know, far more offenses are creating more open guys, more so than ever before in NFL history. And a lot of that helps when an open throw is 45 yards down the football field. If you have an arm that can put it there like that, the windows are a lot bigger down the football field when you do have that arm strength. When you don't have that arm strength, the windows, the holes and those sort of stuff collapse. So it's the guys that can really open up that level of the playbook and then open up the running aspect of the playbook where nothing kind of brings the defense to its knees and limits what you can do than a running quarterback. They're not running quarterback, mobile quarterback, a guy who can threaten you with the option game, with, like I said, the outside the pocket stuff, because that's just another way to create. And so I think these offensive coordinators, the minds proliferating around the NFL, are creating more and building their offenses for the quarterbacks instead of plugging a quarterback into their offense.
So I agree, man. The interesting trend to me is the two of the better play callers in the NFL, Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan, having good quarterbacks that just, you know, execute their offense. Having a Jared Goff, having a Jimmy Garoppolo, guys where they both signed big contracts, which was the standard in the NFL for years. If you found a starting quarterback that wasn't trash, you signed him to a contract, right?
Yeah.
And they both did that. And then they got to a point where they were like, actually, I want more. I need more than that. I need to have somebody who's going to work beyond the system. So I thought, I don't know if this is going to be the next common trend, which is essentially we're not satisfied with a starter. Because if you're just ranking quarterbacks, you could, within the last few years, you could easily make a case that Goff or Garoppolo at any given point was in the top 15, top 12, wherever you want to put them. And both teams just said, actually, I'm going from Goff to Stafford. And the Niners, I'm going from Garoppolo to Trey Lance. And so does that end up becoming the trend where like a starter just isn't good enough because teams have to, they want that top 10 guy or just that ability to keep defenses off balance?
I think so. And I think we're going to see it with the Baker Mayfield and Lamar Jackson extensions, I think. And could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to just give those guys the extensions right away. I think they're going to learn from the Goff, the Wentz, and be like, hey, you know, these kind of inconsistent passers, guys who have been up and down in that regard, until they really show it, until they really show they can create those explosive plays with their arm consistently, it's going to hold off, because it's that can screw you way faster, giving him that big deal, than kind of what happened with Dak Prescott, where they waited it out. Yeah, you finally give him the big deal, but now you still got Dak and you still got a good roster run.
I look at Dak, and at the time, I was wary too as far as locking him up because of everything that we're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, is Dak really, can you really separate him from 10 or 12 other quarterbacks around the league? There was a point where you couldn't. I'm a little bit more sold on him, I think, over just the last year plus of watching him, but at the same time, nice.
And honestly, as bad as it sounds to say, I think the ankle injury and then the comparison between him and Andy Dalton in the same offense helped him.
Oh, it absolutely helped him. I was wrong on that. I thought it was going to hurt him because first off, the offensive line completely fell apart. They ranked 27th in our rankings, and
they were both tackles. No one's gonna. Yeah,
yeah. They were a disaster. But if the Cowboys O line was healthy and Dalton was under center, and you have that trio of receivers, I think that's a productive offense. And Dalton did show flashes, but then he was really bad with the playoffs on the line and all that. I'm with you. I do think it helped. That plus Dak throwing, you know, 450 yards per game on the way in.
True.
I've heard you mention before when you talk about arm strength, the deep crossing route. Is that like, so when you're evaluating arm strength, do you have certain throws you're looking at? What do you Because I've heard you say, hey, if a guy can't make the deep crosser in today's NFL, there's like a certain zip to it, right?
I like to look at the guys like 50-plus yard throws. Just,
you do.
Just go to immediately the farthest throws they've made. That was like the first thing I watched in this quarterback class.
Maybe you've devolved.
Like the ones that they really can pump. And just to see. And then you watch. I like to watch, like, put all the guys on tape back to back to back together. Just kind of see what that looks like for all of them.
Yeah.
And obviously in this year's class, the difference between Lawrence. I think Lance had quite easily, not easily, but like when watching all those, Lance is the one who's came out like that one has cooked just a little bit hotter than the rest, even though they all have big arms. And then besides Jones, then, who was like, those were him putting it all, those were, you know, rainbows. And it was 50 plus yards. He had to give it a, you know, a Russell Wilson-esque deep ball, but Russell Wilson has a cannon and throws it just, that's just stylistically how he throws his deep ball. But I do like to watch the longest throws, and after that, outside the number stuff is where, because can you? Yeah, you could throw hard, but when you throw hard, is it still accurate?
Right.
And that's the biggest thing with, I worry about with Mac Jones, is that when he is throwing deep, and you watch his tape in Alabama, and yeah, he had a lot of deep completions, but his sort of distance control, it's like he has to play a 3-iron when all these other guys are playing 7-irons for 40-yard throws.
Ooh, that's a good comparison.
And so it's like the Bryson DeChambeau of golf. He's hitting wedges in when everyone else is hitting. When you can hit a wedge, that 40-yard throw is a lot easier.
I make fun of the scouts that say they had to be there and watch a guy in person and all. You feel like you're evolving into the got to be there to see the arm strength guy. But I will say, I was at when we did the little training camp tour a couple years ago. It was Geno Smith and Ryan Fitzpatrick were in Jets camp running the same offense, and Fitz was what you're describing Mac Jones to be. I mean, it was like a crow hop to get the ball down the field, but he also just ran the offense so much faster and more efficiently, whereas Geno was just a touch late on everything, and then just the spiral was beautiful. But it's one of those things that you can look at and quantify, but it might not matter. I mean, the same year I watched Sam Bradford was in camp before he got traded with the Eagles and Carson Wentz, and I thought Bradford had the most beautiful tight spiral I've ever seen. And Wentz has a cannon for an arm. And the ball came out of Bradford's arm even better. I mean, it just came off his hand even better. So it's one of those things that, like, it's nice to see, it's nice and all that stuff, but it, like, you just can't overrate that stuff.
What was that one, the week one game that Bradford just dialed it up? Was that when he was with Minnesota, right after he got traded to Minnesota?
He just
lit the world on fire, and he had that one, like, crossing route that went right over a defender's
shoulder.
While, like,
he was getting smoked.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was one of the prettiest throws ever. They had the angle right behind him, and it just looks gorgeous.
It's like on my Twitter somewhere.
It looks like someone, you know, throwing a dart from, like, mile away into a dartboard. It was beautiful. Yeah,
he had two absolutely incredible games with the Vikings. It was the first week of 2016, I believe, against the Saints. Oh no, 17 was against the Saints, and there was a game against the Packers, I think.
See, we need Eric to come back on.
Every single one. I know.
He would put us to shame.
I used to have good recall.
He would have the whole game
back
recalled for us.
I used to have good recall, and then Eric shows up, and he's got better recall. It knows everything.
But I will say, the Rams are coming around to our method. You saw about how they're not sending their scouts to the Senior Bowl anymore. They're trying to keep them home as much as possible, to watch as much tape as possible, to focus on that part of it and use GPS data and that sort of stuff to evaluate the physical aspects and not overrate how the guy looks in shorts, how the ball comes off his hand, and actually rely on hard, fast things that you can kind of measure, and how a guy actually plays a game of football instead of how he might look in a practice setting.
That is the next step. Daniel Jeremiah mentioned it, you know, teams having tracking data. And I can't reveal what we're doing yet, but we'll be there as far as having the tracking data. And that will be a game changer. You know, instead of a snowy morning in February at the combine determining how fast you are, it'll be all 400 routes that you ran in college, you know, and we'll have speed and change of direction and all that stuff. And it already exists in some circles, but I think NFL teams don't have it all yet. That will change things. And then being able to compare that directly to the NFL and saying, this is what an NFL receiver does, this is what an NFL cornerback does, and being able to make those comparisons and figuring out again where that stuff actually matters. People have already done some good work even on just pass trajectory and velocity and stuff like that, right? Because there's certainly more than just pure velocity.
Yeah, I think anytime you can take away the subjectiveness of, ooh, that was, that looked fast.
Yeah.
Well, it's like a guy looks fast, and it happens a lot at small schools, you know, F or group of five stuff, where it's like, oh, that that corner looks fast. Well, he's the, it's because the wide receiver is going up against runs 4-7.
I hate you know? That.
It's like, ooh, look at that makeup speed. Well, it's because the guy he was running against isn't going to sniff the league and just came off, you know, the street. So
I thought Rashard Higgins in college looked really fast. I mean, that dude had – he averaged like 25 yards on screen passes.
Yeah.
He'd take him to the house, and he ran like a 4.68 or whatever at the combine. He's been a good NFL receiver, but I thought he was a good athlete in college at Colorado State. What about guys who show up in the NFL and just look small? Like, I thought Tua just looked small last year, and I thought the arm looked small. I that's one thing I can't stand either. is when a guy just looks different. When you see him in an NFL.
No, that was Burrow with me. I was like,
really?
I always thought arm was not strong, but then he comes in year one and I was like, oof, that's about like bottom of the barrel in the NFL. It's about as weak as it gets. Now, they've been talking about a zip. You know, they've talked about him lifting, and T. Higgins has said it's got a little more. So his hands were hurting, but he needed it because he was, like I said, about as weak as it gets in the NFL.
Well, I've always been of the mind, I'm as a former thrower, Mike, you can. It's not like you add 5 to 10 miles an hour in your 20s, but I honestly think it depends on what your training has been previously. And if you haven't trained up to when you're 22 or 23 and you do train properly, there's a reason why people in Major League Baseball are all throwing high 90s, like everybody in the bullpen's high 90s into 100. The training programs are that much better. So I will say you can improve velocity, but it depends on what your starting point is if it's bad.
I mean, Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, of course.
He came into the NFL, was not – no one was raving about Aaron Rodgers as
Brady
this God-tier
too.
Arm. Yeah. Like, no one was raving about that. And then NFL weight rooms, obviously he was very young when he was drafted. What is he? Just turned 21, maybe not even.
Changed his throwing motion a little bit and everything.
All of a sudden, he's got, you know, about as strong an arm as we see in the past decade. Yeah.
And even if you watch Brady's rookie season in 2011, like, he was floating the ball, and there was a reason why he went in the sixth round. He didn't have a cannon in college. But his short and intermediate velocity has always been as good as it gets.
I've said that with, I think, Zach Wilson. We could see a bump in even him, and he even has a hose right now. But he's very underdeveloped physically and young.
Yeah.
And just the way he throws his all arm, if he just gets a little like lower body strength to him, I think he can add some velocity also.
That was a big part of Rodgers, too. He's just got such great torque in his lower body. So there's mechanical things as well, too. Before we get into the 2022 draft, don't forget, PFF has partnered with Symbol. That's S-I-M-B-U-L-L. More ways to gamble here, Mike. The stock market for sports that allows you to trade sports teams like stocks and earn cash payouts when your teams win. Symbol has blended sports and the stock market to offer you a new way to invest and profit off your favorite teams. You can bet on your Brewers because MLB is in full swing. Rest of the summer, you can do all that. Daily cash payouts. NFL is still having moves, big moves. Julio Jones going to the Titans, so you can still bet on NFL teams here in the middle of the summer. So whoever lands the next Julio, be sure to get in there early. Use the promo code PFF. Deposit $10 at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free PFF annual subscription. It's promo code PFF with a $10 deposit at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free annual subscription.
Have you seen Ohio is closing in on maybe legalizing sports betting by the fall?
Really?
Will you bet if they do in here? If they do, would you?
I could dabble here and there.
I definitely would. I don't now. I will. I know people that go over to Indiana just to hop at a gas station and then place bets.
Really?
And come back.
That's not you.
Not
now.
Me. Not
but the convenience
interest.
Factor would.
But man, if it was convenient, yeah. My brother live bets golf because he lives in Chicago, and I'm like, you have to have better things to do than live betting golf. That's.
Oh man.
But he's like, he gives you a little vested interest in each hole.
I've never been that into it. To gambling in general, but it'll be good for our business. I'll say that. the more people that are interested in numbers that will help them make money.
Yeah,
let's just say that. Let's touch on Aaron Rodgers really quickly,
okay?
Because you talked about it. What's your prediction? What happens with Rodgers?
Wearing a Rodgers jersey yesterday at the Reds game. Got a lot of go Packers. A few people saying he's going to play
the Brewers game. You were
I was at the Brewers Reds game. Brewers lost.
Did you say hi to Lorenzo for me?
No, he's on the IL.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, sadly, didn't play. But I don't think he's playing for the Packers anymore.
Really?
The
further we get into June, though,
he doesn't talk to his own family. This is the thing I keep going back to.
I agree.
He's one of the most stubborn, self driven individuals in, you know, NFL history. If he has made up his mind on something, which I don't think he's posturing at this point, because the contract situation, it's not a contract situation that's like untenable. If that's what it was, if he's made up his mind on something, It's not going to you're not going to change his mind. Is what I'm of the opinion. So I just think that the Packers would be smart to recognize that and sell high. You're not going to get, he plays, even if he plays at an MVP level again this year, and I, again, like I said, I don't think he's going to play for the Packers. Even if he does, you're never going to get more from a trade that you get right now. You get a lot for him.
Sam, I completely disagreed with Sam's take on the worst. He said that the worst case scenario for the Packers was trading him and then having him go win a Super Bowl elsewhere. When I was like, well, the worst case scenario is retirement.
Yeah, that's the worst case.
Because you get nothing in return.
And that's very likely if they try to call his bluff, in my opinion.
Oh, man. So you really don't even think – you don't even think they just reconcile for like a year? Because so isn't his rift is more with the structure of the organization and the whole deal, right? But not LaFleur, right?
Not LaFleur.
And it's been positioned because people have tried to talk about their little feud for the last 2 years and this and that, but clearly they were best friends last year. You know, we're using motion more. We're doing this. We're throwing 44 touchdowns and 4 picks.
Yeah. No, it's not LaFleur. It's not players on the roster. I don't even think it's the drafting of wide receivers. It's just the treating – players like it's a business instead of their family, sort of thing. Like not giving that respect to the guys who have rightfully earned it. And I don't blame him whatsoever if that's his take on it. I mean,
so is that a structural issue in Green Bay that there are figureheads, but there's not the figurehead, right? You're not going to Shad Khan, or you're not going to
that's
Robert
why I think
Kraft.
That's why I think it's not going to be solved, because there's no guy to fire. It's they all make decisions.
I'd get rid of
together.
Yankee. Get rid of Nathan. Get him out of there.
You have Mark Murphy as the president, but he answers to the board, who he's the president, but they make decisions together with Gutekunst, who's more the evaluator. And it's this whole thing that I think is upset at everyone there, not just, hey, you fire Gutekunst and we're good. It's just the way they've gone about their business.
So this is what I do here. I don't stay on schedule. That reminded me of something.
Okay.
Goot said something in his press conference. I don't know. Did you hear his press conference at all after the draft?
Yeah.
Talking about Amari Rodgers.
He was wearing like the funeral suit. All black.
George couldn't get over it. George mentioned it 15 times. If you had the over on how many times George was going to mention his suit on the draft show, you won. But he mentioned for Amari Rodgers, you know how we sit here and we're like, oh, you got the trade chart and you got to do this and here's the strategy. He said, just go get him. And he was telling the story about when they Ted Thompson went to get Clay Matthews, mm-hmm. you know, over 10 years ago. And, you know, he just said, go get Clay Matthews. And everybody's like, oh, what do you want to give up? He said, just get the player. I don't care. Yeah. He didn't even care. That's what the Packers did with Amari Rodgers. Is that, what are your thoughts on that strategy? Go get this one player. I don't care what it takes.
I mean, so that's been his MO, which was not Ted Thompson's MO. I'm a team Ted Thompson all the way.
That was a rare move for Ted to say that about Clay.
The biggest thing that Ted Thompson, his biggest downfall, was not recognizing that salary cap was going to skyrocket. I thought the way he went about with trading down, not ever pigeonholing himself into one player, trying to make sound business decisions when at all times, was the correct way to sort of build around Aaron Rodgers. Just give yourself this big window, and at some point you'll hit. The biggest thing he screwed up was not sort of plugging that roster's holes, realizing that the cap hit was not going to be unmanageable and unworkable in the future years. Like, you didn't have to keep all this space just in case, you know, XYZ happened. The cap was going to double, or the cap was going to keep going up. It started at like $125 million in 2010, and then it got up to, or even less than that, maybe like $110 million, and it got up to $200 million over the course of a decade. And just not seeing that that was going to happen, I think, was their biggest downfall. Losing players like Casey Hayward, Micah Hyde, that did not sign big deals elsewhere, that they just could have easily fit under with a little bit of cap magic. Not even a little bit of cap magic, just could have fit under, but just didn't have that foresight.
Yeah, I pick my spots, but I like to listen to some of those press conferences because you get nuggets like that where you just get into the brains of the evaluators. I thought Chris Ballard had a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, and then every team found football players. Every team. It's not even an advantage because there was, 257 or whatever players drafted that just love football. So it's not even an advantage anymore because every team got guys who love football.
Players, guys who fit their culture.
So speaking of guys who love who loves football in the 2022 draft, high level, you're early in the evaluation process here, right? We're going to have a preseason draft guide again.
Yes.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of this draft?
It's going to be, and much needed, if you look at the NFL landscape today, probably the best cornerback class that we've seen since we started doing this here at PFF.
Best one? Really?
Yeah. If they all declare. Now, it's a very good cornerback class. You have, obviously, Derek Stingley Jr. People have been talking about him since freshman year. Highest grade, PFF grade as true freshman. You know, Derwin James-esque when he came out. Was the highest grade as a freshman. He's going to be a dude. You got Kyer Elam from Florida, who's exceptional as well, just kind of an all-around corner. Ahmad Gardner, Sauce Gardner, hometown guy.
Yeah.
Actually, even from Cincinnati.
I heard he's going to be on the show, right? Austin's working. We're going to get him on the show.
But he's been another guy, a true freshman, 90-plus coverage grade, long, athletic dude. You have Martin Emerson from Mississippi State. You have Andrew Booth from Clemson. You have Darren Kendrick, who just transferred to Georgia. You got a lot of guys who could be in that first-round mix at the cornerback position. So probably one of the strong cornerback classes. Like how I felt about last year's wide receiver class heading into the season, that's how I would say about this cornerback class, which like this could be very, very good.
Is it going to be another – we've had back-to-back really good receiver classes. Now, we're just a few years removed from the year Calvin Ridley came out and Michael Gallup. I remember DJ Moore, but we were putting the rankings together and we were like, everybody feels like the third or fourth best receiver in the class. Nobody felt like a one, even though those guys all ended up being productive.
Yeah.
Do you think it's the nature of the receiver position though? From an evaluation perspective, it's easier to look at a receiver and say, he can do this, this, and this. And if that's what you ask him to do, he's productive and he's a two or he's a three. And that's valuable versus corner. It's not even about what they can do. It's like, well, you can't really have weaknesses because in the NFL, you got to play zone, you got to play man, you got to play press, yeah. You got to play off. Do you think we're too favorable in wide receiver evaluations because the nature of the position lends it to what he can do?
I agree. Yeah, I think we are. Where it's like, oh,
we in general,
he
not
fits perfectly
PFF,
into
but,
XYZ scheme. If you have a slot role, they just throw him screens every time. Oh, he's going to be great. It's like, yeah. That's probably – there's zero chance it's going to actually be his role in the NFL. So, yeah, I do think you can overrate saying this guy does one thing well, just have him do that one thing. It's not how necessarily an NFL offense works. So I do agree with that assessment.
The DK Metcalf example, though, is a good one, right? Because you said if he's a vertical receiver and uses his speed and uses his body on slants or whatever, it's like he could be really productive. And I know he does a few more of those things in Seattle, but it's pretty much that, right? It's like go balls and back shoulders and slants and you got the best deep ball thrower and it works out. You can't actually do that at the NFL level. So corner.
But that's where, and as I said, why we focus on winning down the football field. Because that's where you can, if you want a guy to just run goes and posts and whatever, that's a role that exists in a lot of offenses.
Right.
Just the guy who goes deep. That is a role. But the guy who's underneath, that is not a role.
So cornerback's really deep. The NFL absolutely does need that. Because I think if you were just ranking the top 10 to 15 corners in the NFL, I don't think there's a clear consensus. They need help in covering these incredible offenses. How about your boy Kyle Hamilton at Notre Dame?
Love Kyle Hamilton. I said there's a few. So last year I thought there was one blue chip defensive player, Micah Parsons. After that, I didn't think there was any guy where it's like he's going to be a stud in the NFL. Like if he doesn't become a stud, it's because of injuries or off field or whatever. I think in this upcoming class, there's a few. I would throw Stingley, obviously, in there. Kyle Hamilton, I would throw in there as well. Notre Dame safety. He's 6'4", 220.
He's huge.
Yeah, he's a unique safety. And so he's Isaiah Simmons-esque, but I think he actually stays at safety.
Really?
Or if not, like plays a Derwin James role. He's not going to be a linebacker. He is a safety. He is that good in space. I brought this up on the two-point drafts. Go listen. But he broke up a dig route against Tutu Atwell, one-on-one. A dig route against Tutu Atwell. Tutu runs a 4.3, whatever. Like one of the fastest wide receivers in college football. Second round pick. This is a safety who is 6'4", 220, and he is stride for stride with him on a dig route.
As a true freshman, right?
This is past year.
Okay.
That shouldn't be possible. You know, that if you are a 5'10", 190 safety, that you shouldn't stick with Tutu Atwell. But he did. He's a monster.
His first pass breakup was as a true freshman against Louisville, and his eyes were incredible on the play. I mean, that's one thing from a safety position. Watching here's what his read's supposed to be, here's where he's supposed to get to. He does that, and then he does something else, which was break on an underneath route. I mean, some of the plays he's made in coverage are absolutely incredible at his size. So the secondary is going to get some help, maybe, in the NFL.
Yeah, Jordan Battle from Alabama is a really good safety, too. It's top of the cornerback class, top of the safety class, and top of the edge class I like better than this past year, probably.
Okay, because, yeah, definitely defensively, I mean, there wasn't a defensive player. When was the first defensive player off the board this year?
Eight. J.C. Horn.
That's right. So I keep – I always – by the way, I don't know if this happens to you. I get more confused by – my old mock drafts. Sometimes I put a guy in a mock in the second round. I'm like, oh, he was a second rounder to that team, and it wasn't reality. So my mind is clouded. But we were talking about a defensive player maybe not being off the board till 10 or 11. He comes off at 8. Mm-hmm. This should be different next year with some of these blue chippers that you're talking about.
Kayvon Thibodeau from Oregon.
Yeah.
DeMarvin Leal from Texas A&M, two defensive linemen that they'll go top 10.
Are you higher on Leal than everybody else at the moment?
I don't know where everyone else – it's still too early to say where everyone else is at on people, but that guy is awesome.
Thibodeau's the one who has all the
– Thibodeau's the one who has all the hype, and rightfully so. I mean, he has the kind of that all-around ideal edge traits of size, 6'5", 250 plus, probably 34-something-inch arms, gets off the ball like he's a wide receiver. He has that skill set that just wins consistently and already uses his length really well. Leo's the one who – so he's 290 plus pounds, 6'4", 290, and he plays edge. He's not going to play edge in the NFL. No one's 290 still playing edge in the NFL. It's a rarity. So
Cameron Jordan,
he's
going to
be in the interior, but he wins. Yeah, he wins on the edge. Like, his first step off the edge is absurd. That guy can get off the ball. So I'm excited to see when he does, if he plays a little more on the interior, what he looks like, because he could be special.
What about offensively? This quarterback class got hyped up a little bit. We always knew Trevor Lawrence was there. Coming into the year, we knew Justin Fields was there. It was those two, and all of a sudden Zach Wilson shows up and Mac Jones shows up, and we knew Trey Lance was in there, right?
Yeah.
Quarterback class, there's no consensus number one yet, but in recent years we've seen Joe Burrow, we've seen Kyler Murray, or is there a consensus number one?
I think Spencer Rattler. I'd be hard-pressed to find a board or someone who doesn't have the opinion that Rattler's number one right now, but I think he's the only one. So on the PFF board, if we think guys a franchise type quarterback that's going to, you know, can be a top 10, 12 quarterback in the NFL, whatever, you line him up at the top of the draft because that's how you should draft.
Right.
If a guy's that good at the quarterback position, you should draft them unless you got Patrick Mahomes. And then, in which case, you're not going to be able to draft that guy. But that's how we line up our draft board. When the draft board comes out, it's only going to be Spencer Rattler at the top and no one else at 2. I don't think there's anyone else right now that I would say is that sort of guy. And the names, Sam Howell, Keaton Slovis, Sam Howell of North Carolina, Keaton Slovis of USC, JT Daniels, Georgia, Malik Willis, Liberty. There are names out there that are talented dudes. I just would not put any of them in that air yet.
Malik Willis is getting all the hype because that highlight reel is ridiculous.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. He's the fun to watch. He's the hashtag fun to watch guy.
I watched only his big time throws first, 20 of them last year, 19 or 20 of them, and I was sold. I think. What do you think of? I've got opinions on his arm. Where do you think his arm stands?
I think it's the strongest of any of these guys, bar none. He had a.
I think it's Allen territory.
Yeah, I do too.
It's Josh Allen land.
It's a monster, and he has like a 30 yard throws that just don't go higher than his helmet.
Yeah.
Because he has a little three quarters release and it just zips. He has really a cannon for an arm.
What do you make of Slovis or Sam Howell and these guys that have, they've been pretty productive tools wise? Are they?
I think Howell has a very strong arm also. He's more, size is going to be the thing with him. He Baker Mayfield-esque size. Like, he's just a shade. He might be 6 foot.
Yeah.
Like 220. Not your athletic, but like Baker Mayfield, he's like athletic enough to make a little bit, but not going to rely on it. And I just, that offense is so just absurdly simplistic.
It's Baylor plus, right? I mean, it's that. And when we describe Baylor,
no one goes full Baylor anymore.
Yeah. The Baylor offense was, again, we always describe this. This was one of the most difficult ones to evaluate quarterbacks because there were literally no reads. It was, spread it out as far as you can across the field, find one-on-one, chuck it deep.
I was going to say, it was counting numbers is what it was. It was how many numbers are on that side, how many defenders are on that side. Pick the one with fewer.
Yeah, my 4 and 5 year old are pretty good at counting right now. They got that.
Yeah.
So
that's why Bryce Petty looks like he did there, and then like he did at the Jets.
Yeah, the Baylor tree is obnoxious to me from a player evaluation standpoint. They're tough.
Yeah.
Emory Jones, Florida.
Emory Jones is my dark horse breakout guy.
That's your guy?
He's very talented. Like physically, what he can do as a runner. What he has from an arm strength perspective. I was encouraged by how he looked against Oklahoma coming in for Trask, obviously, after the wheels came off with Trask in that game. Not putting him in any sort of first, second, third round conversation yet, but I do think the tools, and obviously he's in an offense with Dan Mullen that's probably going to set him up to look good.
They've used him as a change of pace a lot the last couple of years as far as running the ball.
He's the runner.
It'll look more like Dak's offense rather, you know, under Mullen.
Yeah,
where Dak, that was the tough part about Dak too. They used him on QB power and counter so much, and he actually was really comfortable just dropping back and chucking it. It was someone else. Matt Corral at Ole Miss. That's another kind of like a Baylor. It's Lane Kiffin, but stealing some of the Baylor-esque concepts. I do Mississippi Radio every week, and they're ready.
All in on Corral.
They're ready. They're all in on Corral in the first round, and I was like, dude, guys, he's listed at 6'1". You know he's probably 5'11 and a half, and that's gonna ding him in the NFL. Do you have any thoughts on Corral?
See, I'm biased against Matt Corral because I love John Reese Plumlee.
Oh, okay.
He was that guy was electric. That was the best runner at the quarterback position in college football.
Yeah, he was.
And just got benched.
Keepers for like 70 yards left and right.
Because they wanted to throw the ball, whatever. But
Corral's a baller.
Corral's he's good. I wouldn't put him close to the air of like even a first rounder at this point. He's very consistent. But
describe. I want to talk Rattler really quick. So he's the clear top guy for you.
Yeah.
What's his skill set like? What are we thinking? When he was recruited, people were like, "Oh, this is just a hybrid between Kyler Murray and Baker Mayfield." Nice job over there at Oklahoma.
So, I mean, stylistically, like the way he throws the ball looks a lot like Kyler Murray. Like the arm, how it whips. I think Seth Galina described him as the Gen Z quarterback. Whatever that, like, if that elicits thoughts in your mind, it did in mine, and it's perfect. Because he kind of takes the sort of what everyone's looking for of the outside the pocket, you know, out of structure plays. He takes that to the extreme. It's all outside of structure with him.
Yeah.
And now he's got ridiculous arm talent, very athletic, add on the run game. But it is not, he is not really playing a lot within the Oklahoma offense. It's a lot of, and they're even like scheming it up. Lincoln Riley is in that offense to kind of give him almost like late reads where it's like, this is a play that's designed to, it goes here, but then 4 seconds late, 4 seconds after the snap, it'll go here. Like your route will break off to this intentionally because we know Spencer Rattler can do this because we know we have an offensive line that can probably do this.
Fascinating. Yeah. I was listening to Seth and their podcast, I think last week they had Coach Voss on talking.
The defense crew.
Just the nitty gritty. X's and O's and all that stuff. Really great stuff. So go check that out. But even just listening to that about how like in 7-on-7, they were saying how when you coach 7-on-7 in high school, there you have like essentially 4 seconds to run a play. So you just, your coverages are different. It's not like cover this zone. When you're teaching defense, it's like cover this zone, but also this one after 3 seconds and all this stuff.
Switch, yeah.
It's almost like the offensive version of that. But it also feels like this adjustment to all the 3-man rushes you see in college football. Just to compare to Brady again, like when you rush 3 against, say, Brady in the red zone, it's happened his whole career. He's patient. Like good quarterbacks are just patient. They're like, oh, I know 3 men are rushing. I know there's going to be a lane to step into somewhere. Whereas other quarterbacks, they're just so structurally trained, they just say, I'm just going
to
go through my reads. But against
within the function of timing.
Yeah. Like I remember Stafford actually doing that a ton. 3-man rush, and he's just like, I'm going 1 to 2 to 3 and throwing it instead of actually saying, let me find the pass rush lane. It sounds like that's Rattler, right? I mean, you've got these 3-man rushes, and it's like, I don't need to throw the ball on time, right? I'm going to
watch me do this.
I'm going to wait. I'm going to make you cover 4 and 5 seconds and break it down.
Yeah.
If there's a thread between Mahomes and Josh Allen as like the breakout players, when you were describing those guys coming out of college, it was they are so comfortable outside the pocket. They're not as comfortable inside the pocket. Mahomes, because he would do this, just leave the pocket, whereas Allen just wasn't really accurate or, you know, timing-wise. Yeah. But they had instincts. They had passing feel. They had playmaking ability. Is that the X factor?
I've said this a few times, and this is not mine. This was Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks on their podcast. They talk about a shooter versus a scorer at the quarterback position. Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, they can score. They can, nothing has to go right with anyone else, and they can put points on the board. A shooter has to get almost schemed open, or like has to get the ball with the lane, has to have a guy open, has to see a guy open. And so the guys that can score are the guys that are winning more in the NFL, winning more in the NBA. You want the scorers. Not to say you can't fill up a box score as a shooter. Like, you can, you know, what's his face? Who's the Klay Thompson can put up 60 in a game, but it has to be because other guys are doing it around him too. You can't just drop a shooter in and ask him to continually win you games.
I like that analogy.
I do too. That's why I use it a lot.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
I mean, because I usually just speak in tiers, QB tiers, and I think ultimately you do get that, those types of guys. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing to me is if you watch Peyton, Brady, Breeze throughout their career, even though it doesn't look like Mahomes, they do actually have elements of that where it's like, hey, everything's covered. I'm still going to put it where it needs to go, exactly. Or I'll buy time. It's not highlight reel plays.
Yeah, it's not always just that. A lot of it can be just throwing a guy open, like a back shoulder to a guy who's covered.
Right.
That was Aaron Rodgers over the course of his career. Like having a guy who, it's nothing's there, but you create it because of how you play the quarterback position.
All right, what else do we need to know about this 2022 draft class? Receivers,
it's a lull at receivers. It is not the all-world class that we've seen before. 1 and 2 on the board are the Ohio State guys, Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave. They're very good. After those two, I would put those two in the first-round mix. There's not another guy where I'm like, first-rounder. Haven't watched the tape. So
it has been cyclical.
The year prior, well, there was probably like five or so guys that you watch at this point. You're like, that guy's probably going to be first-rounder.
So it is cyclical,
yeah.
The receiver thing. People like to speak trends. Oh, there's going to be 5 receivers in the first round every year.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to be the case this upcoming season. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean but I do think there is an influx of wide receiver talent. Like, it is somewhat of a trend, but it's not, oh, every class is can't miss guys now. So
I think the hardest position to predict how strong it's going to be is O-line, because there are so many guys. It is the position where you see consistent development. Guys get stronger in the whole thing, so they'll be quote-unquote breakout players.
Yeah.
But is there an early view across the line if it's strong or lower on first-round talent?
I think it's definitely lower than this past year. This past year was ridiculously deep. It doesn't have the top end that we had 2 years ago either. That one's – I don't see a lot of classes matching that, where he had Wirfs, Becton, Wills, Thomas. But I do think there's a number of guys that I would put in first-round conversation right now. Evan Neal from Alabama at tackle. He's the right tackle this past year. Tyler Lindebaum from Iowa is the center. Now he's put a lot of interior offensive linemen in the first round, but he...
He was in our preseason top 50 last year.
Yeah.
And then back to school.
Beat Tristan Wirfs wrestling in high school.
Really?
Beat Tristan Wirfs wrestling. I don't think he lost maybe like one other time.
Oh, give me that guy. Yeah.
You want that guy.
Yeah, I want that guy on my team. Absolutely.
Yeah. And he started defensive line at Iowa as a freshman and then switched over to center, and he's been their center the last 2 years.
I like that.
Right.
What about Andrew Thomas this year? I know you had some thought on it. I'm bouncing all over the place. Giants offensive tackle, struggled early on. He was our top tackle coming out, and he was not great as a rookie.
Every single person on that Giants line, I want to know who their offensive line coach was. I mean, they fired him midseason, right? They wasn't that right? Because even guys like, who's the left guard there that we like coming out? Will Hernandez. Career worst pass blocking grade. Career worst. Like, that was year 3.
Right.
And he has the worst.
And that's when you're supposed to be getting better.
You know?
Yeah.
No one was pass blocked. Like, they just, whatever they were coaching, whatever they were telling these guys to do, was not working for anybody. So I'm making excuses for myself right here.
Yeah.
But Kevin Zeitler. 59.2 pass blocking grade last year.
Kevin Zeitler,
one of the
season,
best pass protectors of the past decade. Like, they were across the board underperforming. And when that's the case, it's like, that seems a little bit of a I do think he makes a pretty significant leap in year two.
I'm trying to defend my number 32 ranking of the Giants offensive line. And I did it on the last podcast. I was just trying to explain. I can see them all getting better. I just don't have evidence right now.
Yeah.
I can see Thomas getting better. I can see it's either Matt Parrott or Nate Solder at right tackle. And, you know, whoever wins that job will probably be solid. If Parrott wins it, good for him. You know, he's a good developmental prospect. They put Nick Gates at center after not even snapping the ball in his college or NFL career. I mean, so there are areas to get better. But yeah, Andrew Thomas was that that big question mark there.
Yeah.
Well, awesome, man. That was great. Anything else you want to discuss while you're on the big show here? Any other good theories or
theories?
Got any theories or scouting terms? Bring it all. What you got here?
We are
on the spot.
We're gonna try to create some new scouting terms. This is gonna be the goal for next.
I sent you one last night. Are you going to implement that?
It's a Tinder linebacker who's good with his hand swiping left and right.
I was listening to the show and you said this guy, you said he doesn't necessarily want to take on blocks. He's just a swipe left, swipe right guy. So I was like, that's Tinder a Tinder backer.
Tinder backer.
Tinder backer.
That one's going to get utilized. That's going to be put into a lot of different Tinder edge. It's this guy who just swipes well.
position.
If you're swiping well, you're
Tinder. Are you going to add Tinder to everything then, huh? Well,
I'm excited to do. We're gonna do the trait grades this summer.
Oh, we're gonna go. Are we gonna go through that?
Yeah, I am.
Excellent.
That's what I'm excited to do.
Do you think it's worth backfilling, going backwards and trying to do it, or are we gonna be too biased?
That's what I think. I think you risk putting bad data if you backfill.
Yeah. So just to explain that. So our goal here at PF, we want to be really good at evaluating players. We want to be as good as possible. And I do think what you talked about at the beginning of the show was the ability to go back and say, hey, we just focused on production early on. We've learned a few things. And Eric has done a really good job in his projection system. And it's like, okay, what data are we going to ingest before we spit out how we're going to project guys going forward? Production is still the biggest one, higher at some positions than others. Athleticism, depending on the position, certainly matters, right? If you're evaluating an edge, get a productive guy who's athletic, you're probably going to hit 80-90% of the time. You're going to be fine. Other positions, it's not as cut and dry. But the one thing that we might be missing is just truly quantifying traits. Not just saying this guy's a knee bender, this guy's got explosive, but actually putting hard numbers to that. And this could help, I think, bridge the gap as far as production, athleticism, and then just describing on-field play, right?
Like it's still subjective nature of, hey, how explosive is this guy? But if you can put it as a more accurate data point than just saying he's explosive, how explosive? You think he's a 9 explosive or do you think he's a 6 explosive? Because those are both explosive. Those probably both get explosive on a scouting report, but they're one might lead to more success, the guys who are really at the high end versus the maybe mid-tier guys.
I like it. I'll play this game with you.
We'll do it.
We're just trying to add more data to the mix.
Yep.
To improve our projections going forward. So check out Mike and Austin Gale. It's the 2-for-1 Drafts podcast, soon to be something else. Complete rebrand coming up soon. We're going to call it
Evolution.
Business Mike and Evolution. Check out me on the Chris Collinsworth podcast this week.
Do that.
So Chris usually has this nice, tight, one-hour podcast. I think we went for over 2 hours this week. It's not easy. Old men like Chris and I going for 2 hours, but we broke down every single team.
Did you have some performance enhancing drugs?
Well, Chris, it was Chris's fault. Okay. He comes in, he's like, let's just go team by team. I'm like, do you know what you're getting into?
32 teams.
We were 10 teams in, an hour into the pod, and I'm just like, we're going to finish this thing, huh? That's how Sam and I end up going for 2 hours all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like, oh, everybody's going to get some love.
Yeah.
We actually forgot the Texans, and by the end, Chris is like, forget it. Texans.
Texas fans wouldn't want to hear it anyway.
They don't need to.
They're off. Yeah. They're taking a year off.
We'll talk to you in 2022 to preview. But go check me out on the Chris Collinsworth podcast and the fantasy podcast. Ian Hartit's doing a great job over there. Subscribe to that one because it's everything you need for fantasy season. And then the PFF 2021 Best Ball Draft Kit is out. PFF.com. So go check that out as well. All right, Mike. We might not have you on the show for a while. So we've got millions of listeners. What else?
Parting shots?
Yeah.
Go listen to 2-for-1 Drafts. It's great.
Yeah. Go listen to 2-for-1. We're trying to prop those guys up, give them a
need it.
It is how has the podcast evolved even before the rebrand?
We've ventured from not as much hardcore player analysis to more talk about just scouting in general and the entertaining aspects of the draft that are that I enjoy, because there's only so much you can like dive into these guys before you get these guys.
I would say, yeah, the high level topics are probably more interesting than like linebacker 15, yeah, most likely. So
I still like linebacker 15 though.
No, it's the fun part here, because sometimes that guy ends up being good. It's it's fun. So anyway, go check them out. Thanks to Mike for joining us. Sam will be back next week. We'll be back here on Monday with more NFL discussion. Don't forget to email me, nflpodcast@pff.com. You might be on the show. You'll be our listener of the week. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you next week.